This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Osteothera plus Ipraflavone from Claire Labs. As we age, forestalling and even reversing bone loss becomes more and more important. Osteothera plus Ipraflavone is a comprehensive formulation that supports optimal bone density. Osteothera plus Ipraflavone is vital for supporting the body in the formation and regeneration of bone to ensure your optimal skeletal health. For more information and to purchase Osteothera plus Ipraflavone, just go to my online dispensary at drhoffmanstore.com. That's drhoffmanstore.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoppe, and I have, I think, what's really going to be a treat for you, because we're going to talk to one of our favorite guests. He's a perennial contributor to Intelligent Medicine, and he is really one of the most gifted and one of the best communicators in the field of integrative medicine. He's Dr. David Perlmutter. And Dr. Perlmutter, of course, in case you've been living under a rock for the past few years, is author of Grain Brain. Subtitled The Surprising Truth About Wheat, Carbs, and Sugar, which is really a revolutionary book with over 1 million copies in print. Dr. Perlmutter is a board-certified neurologist. He's one of very few accredited neurologists who's in the field of integrative medicine, a true pioneer. Four-time New York Times bestselling author. He's written other books as well that have been extraordinarily popular. He's all over the media. He lectures extensively to doctors. He's been the recipient of numerous awards, including the Linus Pauling Award for his innovative approaches to neurological disorders and many other accolades. He's got a new series on PBS. We'll talk a little bit about it, Dr. Perlmutter's Whole Life Plan. And I understand we're about to celebrate the 5th anniversary of Grain Brain. David, it's
a pleasure. That's right, Dr. Hoffman. We are coming out soon.
Indeed. Yes. Yeah, so time flies when you're having fun, but that book has really revolutionized our approach to neurological disease prevention. You know, I think one of the when I was back in med school, you know, we had to make the choice, capital T, capital C. You know, what field are you going to subspecialize in? And I thought about neurology, but you know, in those days, you know, the meme was neurologists can diagnose, they can slice and dice and parse all kinds of ailments, but they can't cure. And that's sort of the depressing aspect of neurology. But it's been an exciting past few years because we've seen the potential of natural interventions, lifestyle supplements, and so on, to not only prevent but reverse such challenging disorders as Alzheimer's disease. And you've been a big contributor to that movement.
Well, you know, again, you mentioned that Grain Brain is coming out after 5 years. Hard to imagine 5 years have gone by, but the exciting thing about that is in preparing the revised manuscript, and we really did a lot of revision, is that the newer information that I've had the opportunity to review really validates what we were out on a limb on 5 years ago saying. And, you know, I said that the mission back then maybe was to think outside the box. The mission now is to make the box bigger. So We really have gained a lot of support from mainstream medicine and even, boy, the U.S. Department of U.S. dietary guidelines have changed to the extent that they are dramatically reducing their commentary on dietary fats and are much more favorable about dietary fat, but really centered on lowering sugar and other carbohydrates, which is, you know, what we were saying with Grain Brain and really really raised a lot of eyebrows because people were really at that time still believing that we needed to focus on eating lots of dietary carbohydrates to be healthy because fat was the cause of everything bad in our lives. When we realize now that that just isn't the case, that's what our medical literature is so supportive of. And as mentioned, even the U.S. dietary guidelines are now really getting away finally from the erroneous castigation of dietary fat and placing that blame where it strongly belongs, clearly belongs, and that is in the lap of sugar and carbohydrates.
And it seems that a Grain Brain works on several levels, as you suggest. On the one hand, it promotes a shift from low-fat diets that are carb-laden to diets which are more based on protein and fat and, you know, of course, lots of vegetables and fiber. We don't have any problem with that. But also, it implicates gluten as a specific problem. It implicates grains as well, because grains may have, there may be something, you know, the paleo diet, of course, eliminates grains, and that may be to the benefit of some people with neurological problems.
That's true. But, you know, to be very clear, I think that there is a place for some grains or grain-like foods in the diet. Some wild, non-GMO, non-treated rice in moderation is acceptable. I actually gave a nutritional lecture the day before yesterday at Paleo FX, you know, speaking to the paleo crowd. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are some available grains, which by definition are the seeds of grass, like rice and like corn, that may be acceptable. But the real issue with grains in general is, of course, their high carbohydrate content. The other issue, of course, most grain that we would consume is wheat, and wheat has in it that protein called gluten that clearly now the evidence is really substantiated that we need to avoid gluten in our diets, not just the 1.7% of Americans who have celiac disease, but really what we were saying back when Grain Brain was written was that there are probably 30% of people who have non-celiac gluten sensitivity. But now it's become clear from work done at Dr. Fasano's laboratory at Harvard that a part of gluten called alpha-gliadin does induce leakiness of the gut in all humans. And, you know, we know that we want to reduce the leakiness of our gut. That's the cornerstone of inflammation, for example, which underlies Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, coronary artery disease, diabetes, and even cancer. So there's so many books out now that are talking about how do we repair the leaky gut when, you know, you and I know that we've been talking about this crazy notion of leaky gut for the past 20 years. Now suddenly it's front and center, but good. You know, some of the best things in life are worth waiting for.
Indeed, indeed. And, you know, you've been someone who's pointed out that our standards for blood sugar control are much too lenient. You know, I see countless patients who come to me and they've got a hemoglobin A1C of 6.1 or 6.2. And I noticed that and I said, didn't your doctor point out to you that you're pre-diabetic and that we really should be doing something about this? And they say no, because they didn't cross that arbitrary borderline of 6.4, which puts you into the full-blown diabetes range. But you pointed out that there's some very, very severe consequences for the brain and the nervous system.
That's right. And, you know, that it's a situation where people will go to the doctor and he or she will say, well, your blood sugar is 110 and you're not diabetic. And the word that hangs in the background there is yet. But, you know, diabetes and issues with the damaging effects on the brain and other parts of the body from blood sugar elevation are not binary. They're not either yes or no, i.e. you have diabetes or you don't have diabetes. It's not like pregnancy, whether you is or you ain't. Diabetes is a disease that we diagnose based upon a particular number of 126 on fasting blood sugar, values of A1C. But that said, according to old literature, New England Journal of Medicine, October of 2013, demonstrated that even very subtle elevations of blood sugar above the so-called normal, which they chose at 100, were associated with a dramatic increased risk for dementia. They took a group of several thousand individuals and followed them for close to 7 years. And the only test they did, these were non-demented elderly individuals, the only test they did at the beginning of the study was measure their fasting blood sugar. And then they came back about 7 years later and they said, who has dementia and who doesn't? They determined based on testing. And they found this powerful correlation between even subtle elevations of blood sugar in the normal range and risk for dementia. So what that says to me is we've really, first of all, need to abandon this notion of the normal range. It doesn't mean anything anymore for your listeners. Your listeners deserve to know what is the optimal range, mm-hmm. what is best for them. And that is certainly blood sugars in the high 80s, maybe the low 90s. when you get a blood sugar already in at 100 or greater, though you're technically not diagnosed with diabetes or even pre-diabetes, you are already increasing your risk for brain shrinkage, for moment-to-moment memory dysfunction, and for long-term risk for dementia. That's what our most well-respected peer-reviewed literature is telling us. So we have to pay attention to that now more than ever.
I think you cited a statistic when it comes to, we're talking, of course, about fasting blood glucose, but, you know, a better metric for blood sugar over time, and in fact, what it's causing in terms of ages or advanced glycosylation end products, which damage the brain and all the organs of the body, is the hemoglobin A1C. And when the hemoglobin A1C, I think I heard you once say that for every point, 0.1, 0.2, 0.3, above 5.6, was it? You increase your risk for dementia by 10%? Am I quoting you correctly?
Yeah, something along those lines. The reality is that the A1C is correlated to a greater risk when it's elevated of dementia than even carrying the what's called the APOE4 allele, the so-called Alzheimer's gene,
right,
which you can't change. But you can sure as heck lower your A1C by stopping the sugars and reducing the carbohydrates and eating more, believe it or not, fat. There's a wonderful study that came out just this year conducted by a Dr. Sarah Hallberg. I actually interviewed her. And she took a group of 150 individuals, and some of them were placed on a standard of care. In other words, these are all type 2 diabetics, and they were just seeing their doctors, medications adjusted as need be over the course of 1 year. The other group was placed on what's called a ketogenic diet. What does that mean? Very, very low sugar, carbohydrates, and elevated levels of good fat. And they also, the other variable, is that they were interacting with their healthcare provider very frequently in a virtual manner. She demonstrated that the people who had the interventions, in other words, nothing more than being put on the ketogenic diet, higher fat, lower carbs, who knew for a diabetic, these individuals, 94% of them who were on insulin either discontinued insulin or were able to reduce it. All of the patients who were taking a class of drugs called sulfonylureas were able to stop them. 100%, the average weight loss was about 14% of body weight, which plays a critical role in what causes diabetic patients to have problems, and that is inflammation brought on by what you mentioned, this glycosylation of proteins, but also from body fat. So it was really, I believe, a study that should have been on the evening news.
Yeah.
Yet all we see in the evening news are new drugs developed for overweight people to treat their type 2 diabetes, you know, and why I want to lower my A1C. Well, it's great to lower your A1C, but if you don't take care of the body fat at the same time, you're still at great risk for complications.
Mm-hmm. And this is actually why some studies have shown, you know, as you know, that drugs that lower blood sugar dramatically actually fail to prolong life or reduce the risk of dying. I mean, ultimately, your numbers look better, but it's not how low you go. It's how you get there. If you get there through pharmaceutical intervention.
That was published in the New England Journal of Medicine back in 2008, where
exactly
they took pre-diabetics and went head-to-head with the drug metformin. These are people without diabetes. They said, well, we're going to put them on a drug or we're going to change their diets and have them exercise. And the outcome was that both groups reduced their rate of converting to full-blown type 2 diabetes. The lifestyle group actually was better at reducing their rate for type 2 diabetes. But more importantly, I believe, the group taking metformin, the death rate was twice as high as the group that simply began exercising and changed their diets.
And that's not even the worst drug. I mean, they're not at all.
I mean
it's a relatively benign.
Are prescribing metformin right now as an anti-aging modality.
Exactly.
But,
exactly.
You know, we've got to remain vigilant about, above all, do no harm.
Indeed. Okay, folks, at this point, let's pause and allow one of our sponsors to share this important message with you. Here goes. As we age, forestalling and even reversing bone loss becomes more and more important. This is Dr. Ronald Hoppen with a comprehensive formulation that supports optimal bone density to ensure your future bone health. It's Osteothera plus Iproflavone from Claire Labs. Osteothera plus ciproflavone helps inhibit bone resorption and promotes new bone formation. The Osteothera plus ciproflavone formulation is vital for supporting the body in the formation and regeneration of bone to ensure your optimal skeletal health. I believe in Osteothera plus ciproflavone so much that I've included it in the Intelligent Medicine Bone Health Protocol, and I recommend it to my patients. For more information and to purchase Osteothera plus ciproflavone, just go to my online dispensary at drhoffmanstore.com. That's drhoffmanstore.com. drhoffmanstore.com. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting our sponsors. They're what make Intelligent Medicine a free resource to you. And now back to our guest, Dr. David Perlmutter. So you mentioned, you know, genetic tests and the ApoE test, and I think that's coming into the popular lexicon, is that is a test that somewhat predicts one's risk for Alzheimer's. Are your genetics your fate? I mean, if you have relatives with Alzheimer's, should you be tested?
I think, you know, if people are going to go all in and dedicate themselves to improving various markers of their various parameters of their lifestyle, you know, they can choose to or choose to not know if they carry one or more of the genetic risk markers for Alzheimer's. But what we're seeing these days, I think, is very exciting. Let me quote two studies if I could.
Sure.
The first was published in the journal Neurology on April 25th, 2017. I know that because it's our anniversary. And what
you
they
better
looked
remember
at
that.
Was three different markers of risk. And they are, as you mentioned, the APOE4 allele, but also two more, one called CLU, one called ABCA7. And why these are risk markers is because if you carry one or more of these, then you have a higher chance of having certain proteins in your spinal fluid that are associated with risk for Alzheimer's, like beta amyloid, also something called tau protein and phosphorylated tau protein. They're not going to be on the quiz, but the point is you have these risk markers. They generally translate into these genetic risk markers translate into having this stuff in your spinal fluid that's not good. And what the study demonstrated was really quite interesting, that if you had the genetic risk markers, but you had a high degree of cardiorespiratory fitness, then it didn't translate as much in terms of having the proteins in your spinal fluid. So you are offsetting your risk for the stuff in your spinal fluid because of the fact that you maintained exercise. You know, one other more recent study looked at, it was published actually 2 weeks ago in the journal Neurology, looked at what is the risk of having a lot of amyloid protein in your brain, which many people believe is associated with Alzheimer's risk, on a very special type of brain scan. In other words, if you have a brain scan that shows a lot of this protein, you are probably at increased risk for Alzheimer's disease. If you carry the gene, the APOE4 gene, your risk of having a lot of this protein in your brain is certainly increased. If you are insulin resistant, meaning you've been eating a lot of sugar, then your risk of having this protein in your brain is even higher. But if you are insulin sensitive, meaning that you have been very careful with your blood sugar, not eating a lot of sugar, eating lower carbs, then your risk for having high protein in your brain, amyloid protein, even if you carry the gene, is dramatically reduced. What am I saying? That here you are presented with a lifestyle change to offset what you would have gotten from your genetic predisposition. So the point is that carrying the APOE4 gene, which is seen in 20 to 25% of Americans, is not a sentence. It's not deterministic that you're going to load your brain up with beta amyloid and develop Alzheimer's disease. You can offset that risk, which is a clear risk, by becoming insulin sensitive, by eating a higher fat, lower carbohydrate, lower sugar diet, and definitely by engaging in aerobic exercise, which is certainly something we should talk about.
Well, absolutely. I mean, so a very hopeful message, because having these genetic modifications, it's not a death sentence. It's a call to action, and it really should be used as a teachable moment to engage people in healthy lifestyle, exercise, supplements. And we'll talk about some of the components of that. But let's focus on exercise, and exercise certainly is a cornerstone to neurological health. In fact, it seems that you can exercise your brain better through cardiorespiratory exertions than through brain-teasing puzzles, right?
You know, if that's all we said today on our time together, and people could really get that message, it would be, I think, a major accomplishment. Repeating what you just said, you can exercise your brain to wellness and to disease prevention, I might add. A study that came out just this year, January 16th, again in the journal Neurology, which is arguably one of the most well-respected neurology journals on the planet, looked at, it was called Practice Recommendations for Treating What Is Called MCI. And MCI is Mild Cognitive Impairment.
I saw that.
You don't have full-blown Alzheimer's yet, but you are on your way. I mean, the conversion from MCI to full-blown Alzheimer's is pretty high, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of at least 38 to 40%. So if you have MCI, meaning you don't just think you're having troubles, but your doctor tests you and says, yeah, you are having some issues, you're on your way to Alzheimer's disease. And the study, interestingly, looked at all of the possible things that a doctor could prescribe to the patient. You know, I think there was 14 different drugs. And it finally concluded saying that not one drug has been validated to help slow the conversion from MCI to full-blown Alzheimer's, except for one thing that you can write on the prescription pad, and it's called exercise. The journal Neurology indicated that there is substantial evidence to indicate that exercise has a measurable effect in slowing the conversion from MCI to full-blown Alzheimer's. That should have been news. Everyone should have been talking about it. But, you know, who can patent exercise?
Mm-hmm. There is this very interesting molecule called BDNF. Can you talk to us about that?
BDNF stands for brain-derived neurotrophic hormone, and or factor in this case. And it is really an important factor that stimulates the growth of new brain cells, the protection of brain cells, and even the connection of brain cells, which we call synaptogenesis. But, you know, with the notion that we can grow new brain cells, neurogenesis, you know, that was pretty iconoclastic when it was first proposed by Dr. Peter Erickson in 1998 in the journal Nature Medicine. That said, what a gift that we can grow new brain cells. For all of us who were told back in the day that every beer caused us to lose 40,000 brain cells.
We would joke in our dormitory about cells. That. Yeah, how many brain cells did we lose last night, you know?
Really, on the head of a pin. But that said, you know, I think that your listeners are probably on the edges of your seats right now, their seats, wanting to know, whoa, BDNF can grow new brain cells. What can I do to get more BDNF? And clearly, one of the most powerful things that we can do to change our DNA to start cranking out the BDNF is aerobic exercise. In fact, that's what Dr. Erickson, a different Dr. Erickson, discovered in a collaborative study with both the University of Pittsburgh and the University of UCLA, that aerobic exercise in the course of 1 year actually increased the size of the brain's memory center, called the hippocampus, in people given an aerobic program in comparison to those who were told simply to stretch, whose brain memory centers actually shrunk during that 1 year period. The exercises had improved memory, and it all correlated to higher levels of BDNF. There are other things that we can do aside from exercise that'll increase BDNF. The omega-3 called DHA is powerful. Turmeric, for example, powerful. A whole coffee fruit concentrate, which is something now available in health food stores, is fairly dramatic in its ability to turn on BDNF production. So we're amplifying gene expression to make good chemicals in our bodies by making certain lifestyle choices when we are confronted with a situation, Alzheimer's in this case, for which there is no pharmaceutical treatment.
Well, that's really a wonderful basis for our discussion in part two. Our listeners know we divide our podcasts into two parts. And in part two with today's guest, Dr. David Perlmutter, who is my good colleague and also author of Grain Brain, and a new edition is coming out that we're quite excited about because it's going to be updating some of the findings from 5 years ago. And In part two, we'll talk about some other components of a program to help prevent and, yes, even reverse neurodegenerative diseases, diseases that we thought were fatal, untreatable, inevitable. But the revolution in our thought is that we can intervene and turn things around. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.